So to begin now our fifth talk for this retreat on freedom, I'd like to begin by expressing my appreciation and gratitude and also a sense of reverence for each of you and your practice. And I want to say this not only because I feel those things and want to express them, but they also relate to the topic of freedom, topic of the talk today. Loved when Matthew Dharma talk yesterday said that something like the self that's loved is the self that can be forgotten. Our self-consciousness and self-preoccupation, it's easier to let go of when the self feels loved. If the self is hated or is afraid, it involves attention. And tension has a way of drawing attention to itself. I was also struck by Matthew saying that the sense of self is experienced as tension. And I've sometimes called my kind of tongue-in-cheek definition of self is that it's wind drag. And so tension. And so when there is no tension, then in a certain way, there is no sense of self. There's a sense of self can be forgotten, or it's not needed so much. And so to love the self as a stepping stone to freedom. And so I want to express my deep reverence and appreciation of all of you. And I'm struck that the teacher Suzuki Roshi, the Zen Center, founder of San Francisco Zen Center, someone once asked why he bows to a Buddha statue and why we bow to Buddha statues. And he said, because we're bowing to ourselves. And as much as I value like the statue we have here at IMC behind me and Buddha statues, they're really a pointer or a stand-in for you and your practice. And the bowing to the Buddha is also, I'd rather bow to you all than to a statue, and bow to all of you for your practice and dedication and what you're doing and how special that is. That each of you is here and practicing, and a sense of reverence even for just for being you as a human being. In Japanese, in Japan, some homes and temples and different places have a custom of having a alcove in the wall. Usually the alcoves are kind of large and tall, and the bottom of it, like a little shelf, is relatively close to the floor. And there's usually nothing in this alcove except one object. Sometimes it's a scroll on the wall, but sometimes it's just it's a vase with a single flower. And there's something about just one flower standing out in highlight in the empty space of the alcove, that the uniqueness and the specialness of each flower stands out for itself. And then the art of Japanese flower arrangement sometimes is the art of arranging that one flower so its uniqueness, its specialness stands out. That can't really happen for a poor flower if it's bunched together with a whole bunch of other flowers in a big bouquet. as pretty as the full bouquet is, a splash of color, the individual flower is a little bit lost. But to have one flower and really highlight it is a characteristic of a mind that is awake. A mind that really is present will see the uniqueness and the specialness of things, the highlight distinctions between things, and each thing is valuable in and of itself. When I sat on my Sesshin, a seven-day Zen retreat, many years ago to San Francisco Zen Center in the Green Gulch Meditation Hall. And the custom back then was halfway through the afternoon, we were normally meditating on these platforms facing the wall, and halfway through the afternoon, we would turn around and we would face the middle of the room, away from the wall, and someone would come and serve us tea and a cookie to fortify us through the rest of the afternoon. And it was all done kind of like tea ceremony a little bit. We're all sitting in silence and just bowing to the servers who come with tea and bringing out our cups. And someone at some point indicates that now we can start drinking, and we all pick up the cup at the same time. And it's kind of like a little choreographed tea meditation. For that particular sesshin, I was sitting next to a Zen monk from Japan who was visiting. Part of this is that the day one, the servers will come in and give you your cup. And then for the next 7 days, you keep the cup. And they just fill it with tea every day. But on the seventh day, after you've had your tea and your cookie, they'll come with a tray and retrieve your cup and take it back to the kitchen. So sitting next to this monk, and everything's choreographed, just, you know, exactly how you're supposed to move, when to bow, when to sit still. It's all arranged. So anybody who does anything that's out of the ordinary stands out. And when it was time for this monk to return his cup, before he returned the cup, he bowed to the cup. And something about the seventh day of silent retreat, having this person next to me bowing to the cup, I'd never imagined anyone would ever bow to a cup. And I was like really struck, wow, that kind of care, that kind of reverence for a cup. But also that kind of care and reverence for each of you. Each of you is important and valuable. And the whole kind of purpose of freedom, experiencing freedom, freedom from suffering in Buddhism, is not to diminish you. It's not to kind of make you into some kind of non-entity who can just go into some kind of retired, enlightened retirement, sitting on the couch watching TV all day because, you know, you have no desires anymore, and reruns of Saturday Night Live are the best thing going. The purpose is really to, you know, there's inherent in Buddhism this tremendous respect, and today's word is reverence, for you and your potential, your capacity, and your uniqueness, and your specialness. And so it belongs in Soto Zen. They talked about, they emphasize Soto Zen is attention to detail. And this bowing to a cup, and how you put down a cup is a detail that you're really there for each experience. You don't just kind of, if you toss trash away, you place it away. Because you, each detail of everything you do, everything is significant. So it's attention to is also a practice of attention to detail. And we don't get many Vipassana teachings about doing so with the world around us, but it is with the moment-to-moment attention. To not kind of be in a general, when vipassana becomes deep, it's not about a generalized kind of amorphous experience, but there's a kind of a clarity of mind that lets us see each thing distinctly. So when you have an emotion is a composite of many different things. And if we're just kind of swimming in the emotion, we have one relationship to it. But if we see that emotion is made up of body sensations, motivations, stories, beliefs, attitudes, moods that we have, then we can begin bringing attention to the details of that, to where the emotion is felt in the body, to what are the stories that seem to come with the emotion. Our relationship to the emotion is part of it all. We can look at, you know, I like it, I don't like it, I'm pushing it away, I'm holding on to it. We can look at what kind of motivation we have in relationship to it like that, like we want it. But some emotions are themselves a motivation, like anger is to push something away. And so we start seeing that as we get quieter and quieter, the uniqueness, the distinctiveness of all the different pieces begins to stand out and highlight. Maybe almost like the alcove in the Japanese homes. Not because we're analyzing, not because we are figuring it out, but rather because the mind gets quieter, stiller, and more clear. It's not distracted, it's not generalizing, it's not interpreting the experience, which is an overlay on top, but it's coming down deeper and deeper to just the particularities of what the building blocks of experience are. And there's a whole different way of relating to this then. And so one of the building blocks of experience is the tensions that we have. And we, sure enough, as we get quieter and quieter, it becomes really clear that the notion of self, the idea of self, is in fact a construct. It's actually something that comes together, coalesces, or coagulates into a kind of attention. And to see that with great clarity is only possible if we've kind of quieted the surface thoughts of the mind, which are telling stories and interpreting and wanting and not wanting, just willing to be really quiet, still, and really sense the details of what's here. And this attention to the particularities and the respect and the reverence for each thing, the love of each thing, in a sense, that allows that tension to dissolve. And then when that tension dissolves, then you won't find a locus for the self. As Matthew said, it's like the center of gravity of an object. You can't exactly find it. You know where kind of it is if you do measurements, but it's not a thing itself. It's kind of a property of things that we can predict by measuring or figuring out what the center of gravity is. But it's not a thing. But that non-thingness is quite important for the object's behavior and how it behaves when under the pull of gravity. So when the sense of self that is attention dissolves, it's actually a marvelous thing. It's a very special thing. It provides a very different reference point for how we live our lives and go through our lives than if the reference point is that tension that's there. But to let it dissolve, I think it, you know, really, it's the idea of reverence. Matthew yesterday talked about love. That reverence to it all, reverence for the self, my reverence for you. And so I'd like to read a poem, a Japanese poem. The It's called The Flower Poem. And the flower represents you. It represents all things, all phenomena. It represents the particularity of each thing in and of itself, the uniqueness of that flower in the alcove, the uniqueness of you, independent of how you compare yourself to others, independent of how you, the stories of your life that preceded you, and the ideas of what's coming, independent of the ideals by which you measure yourself. Just you yourself, standing in your pristine simplicity. So here's the flower poem. The world is a flower. Enlightened beings are flowers. Unenlightened beings are flowers. Red flowers, white flowers, green flowers, black flowers, all the different kinds of the colors of flowers, all the different kinds of loves shining forth. Such an immense universe, so many beings, each a flower. Flowers of gratitude, flowers of sorrow, flowers of suffering, flowers of joy, laughter's flowers, anger's flowers, each connected to the others and each making the others grow. When our clear mind's eye opens this world of flowers, all beings shine. Music echoes through mountains and oceans. One's world becomes the world of millions. The individual becomes the human race. All lives become the individual. Billions of mirrors, all reflecting each other. There is death, and there is life. There is no death and no life. There is changing life, and there is unchanging life. Flowers change color moment by moment. Such a vivid world, such a bright world. You were born out of these flowers. You gave birth to these flowers. You have no beginning and no ending. You are bottomless and limitless, even as you are infinitesimal dust. You are a flower. You are love. All beings shine out of their uniqueness. All melt into the oneness of colors. You are one. You are many. Only one moment. Only one unique place. Only the unique you. Beside you, there is nothing. You dance, appearing in all. You came from peace, and you will return to peace. You stay nowhere. You are nowhere attached. You occupy everything. You occupy nothing. You are the becoming of indescribable change. You are love. You are the flower. And as a flower, you are everything and you are nothing. So the attention, the ability to be quiet and still enough, or at least the thoughts be quiet enough, still enough, that we're not looking through the filter of our ideas and stories and judgments and our resentments and our shame and our fears, our conceit, but rather we're looking through clarity at the uniqueness of each moment experience here. And what we'll see is that as we go into this practice of vipassana deeper and deeper, we will see that there are places of tension, places of holding, of attachment. And we'll see that that's a kind of suffering. It hurts to do that. There's an ouch when we hold on and cling. And as the practice deepens, it's a deepening or an expansion of what we're willing to let go of, or what we allow to dissolve and release itself. When we first sit down to meditate, maybe we haven't heard that we're, you know, to let go of anything. But if even if you're not given any meditation instruction, but you're told to sit for a week quietly and watch your mind, I think a fair number of people, after a while, will begin letting go of some of the things they're thinking about. It's enough already. This is no need anymore. And we let go of all kinds of things. We let go, and in some ways, maturing as an adult is letting go of a lot of things we were attached to when we were younger. Many of us, you know, that some of the things we were caught up in around sense of self and what other people thought of us when we were young probably doesn't carry much weight anymore, because without thinking about it, we're no longer concerned about having zits on our face. But when I went to junior high school, going to school with a zit on my face was major news and major concern. And I don't care anymore about zits on my face. There was a time in my life where I cared a lot about my hair. And I used to pull my hair to make it longer. But I don't really care about my hair at all, hardly at all. I don't have much attachment to hair anymore. I've had shaved heads, and I've had hair that went down almost my belly button. I've had all kinds of things. But the hair, you know, doesn't matter anymore. I remember when I was 18, I had a period of time I was concerned about split ends. Some of you maybe had concern about split ends, but I don't have any concerns like that anymore. So there's a lot of stuff that I've let go of, you know, and those are just kind of, you know, the first things that came to mind sitting here. And so there's this process of letting go. And as we get deeper and more settled, we realize we need to let go of more of our thoughts, let go of thoughts of yesterday or tomorrow. We let go of our desires and our wishes, our fantasies. We let go of the things that we're clinging to tight, because we realize we don't need them anymore. It just hurts too much to keep clinging. And so as we get more concentrated, more still and quiet, one way of understanding that it's a progressive path of letting go of clinging and of attachment. And as we do this, many people sooner or later will feel the goodness of that, the benefit, how nice it is. It's lighter, it's clear, more settled. Some people say it's a kind of coming home. It's more peaceful. And it gets a very interesting point in meditation practice when you get quiet enough and settled enough that you see a thought, an ordinary, everyday, ordinary thought, the kind of thought that you might have, you know, tens of thousands of times every day. You see the thought begin to appear, And the thought occurs to you, why bother? Why would I get involved in that? Because if I get involved in that thought, I have activating my mind again, and I'm losing the peace. It's an agitated movement to be involved in that thought. I prefer this kind of this peaceful state. It's much more intimate. It's much more alive. It's much more clear. It's much more peaceful to not think about that than it is to think about it. And to have that reference point of a peace or subtleness is a powerful reference point. It teaches us something, and we see the difference between picking up something which has an ouch in it or discomfort in it and leaving it alone. The deeper the practice goes, the stronger and stronger reference point we have of how we pick things up, how we get involved, what the role of clinging and attachment and resistance is in our lives. And we see it in deeper and deeper levels that are unimaginable in a surface mind when we're running around town and taking care of business and doing things. We don't really see what's going on under the hood in our being. And sometimes this is frightening, sometimes disorienting, but ultimately it just feels like the safest thing you can do to come to this deep place of no longer clinging. And it's all the process of letting go. And when you come to some of the deepest letting go, you're left with nothing. There's nothing you're clinging to anymore. So the hand is no longer grasping anything. The hand now is empty. And that emptiness, that absence of clinging, like the center of gravity that Matthew talked about, it's not anything, but it's still phenomenally meaningful and significant. And the idea that something which is nothing can be significant is not easy to understand. And to understand that nothing is actually ultimate in Buddhism is even harder to understand. In fact, if you go to a party or something, someday maybe you'll go back to parties, and someone you don't know or someone asks, what about your spirituality, your religion? Oh, you do Buddhism. Oh, I see. What is the ultimate teachings of Buddhism? It's a reasonable question. Someone wants to know. And you can say, oh, it's nothing. And then they look at you like you're really weird. And they say, well, I have a better relation than that. We have something great and ultimate and of cosmic significance, and it's really the most powerful, greatest thing in the universe, and all you have is nothing? And you say, yep, that's all we got. Nothing. Well, then they feel sorry for you. Poor you. I feel, wow, that's not much to have nothing. That's all you can say for yourself, for your Buddhism? And you say, well, I can't say more about it. I can say how wonderful that nothing is. In fact, there's kind of a Buddhist riddle that says how is it that one is poor when having something, but is rich when having nothing? Having something, one is poor. Having nothing, one is rich. So when does that work? And the riddle is that the answer to the riddle is that when the mind is holding on to anything, there's a poverty there because it always limits us. And it limits us, when you hold on to anything, it limits us from really experiencing the boundless, limitless dimensions of this human life of ours. And especially so if we attach and hold on tight to a sense of self. any kind of sense of self, that we're supposed to be this kind of self and that kind of self. And some of these selves are reasonable, but to hold on to it and not let go of it is a kind of poverty, because the fullness, the richness of our life is not available. But when we have nothing, no holding on to anything, then we're rich, because then we have everything in a sense. Having nothing, in a sense, we have everything. Having something, you almost have nothing. That's kind of the Buddhist riddle. But this idea that there's, that at the core is this deep, deep ending, cessation, dissolving of that tension of self, that tension of holding to anything at all. The tension of holding on to stories, memories, the tension of holding on to being right and our opinions, the tension of being anything, being smart, being beautiful, being terrible, being inadequate, being more than adequate. If those are ideas we hold on to, those are all limiting us. And to see that the uniqueness of that, not as something to be critical of, as to blame, but to see even our suffering and our tensions and our holding on with reverence. Each is a flower. Each in its own uniqueness, sitting in the alcove, is something that we can in a certain kind of way bow to. Because when we see each thing in its own uniqueness, as even if it's an ouch, we're seeing it in a wider context of freedom, of space. So the idea that you have to get rid of something to have this kind of sacred dimension of attention is to be a little bit poor, because that's just another attachment to get rid of something. But to see each thing as it is and not to be in a hurry to dissolve or to let go, and allow the deeper work to just dissolve and soften and unwind, release. And the deeper we go in the practice, the more that letting go is something that we have to allow to happen, not something we can no longer do. We can't keep letting go. And so that learning this art or this attitude of love, of reverence, of care, of attention that can allow us each thing to be as it is without us being entangled with it, for or against, trying to or caught up with using anything that happens as a way to define ourselves. If we have an unwholesome thought, there's no need to now think that you're a bad thinker. If you have a wholesome thought, there's no need to define yourself as, now I'm a good thinker. It's possible to just let the thought be a thought, just a flower, just its own unique thing, without making any reference to what that says about you. And so we're learning more and more to leave things alone, to let go of the grip, the tension, the holding. And we start trusting that letting go. And we see the peace of it, the deep, deep letting go. And that the ultimate freedom then in Buddhism is not actually an experience of freedom. And I think that many people have an idea, measuring their spirituality, their meditation, by having by experiences. You can have experiences in meditations. You can have experience of calm, of peace, of concentration, of joy, of strong experiences of interconnectedness, mystical experiences. There's lots of different things you can experience. It turns out that the ultimate freedom in Buddhism is not really an experience. If it's an experience, in some senses of the term, you wouldn't really be free. The ultimate experience, I keep using the word anyway, the ultimate event of freedom is the absence of something. The absence, the radical and full absence of clinging. And to know that that's possible, to know that that's safe, to know that that's actually one of the very most wonderful ways of being, is the teaching that we receive from this radical absence of clinging. And so it's quite ultimate that we as Buddhists have as our ultimate nothing, an absence. And it's hard to grok, it's hard to appreciate when the mind is always concerned about things and ideas and thoughts. Most minds are minds of aboutness. We're thinking about something, and we go from one aboutness to the next aboutness. Like monkeys swinging in a tree, before they let go of one branch, they're already grabbing for the next branch. By the time, before we've stopped thinking about one thing, we're concerned about the next thing. But this radical freedom is a place where the mind is become free of thinking about things. We're no longer monkeys swinging along and grabbing at one thought, one idea, one experience after another. We're still aware of all those things, but we're not swinging from them, one to the other. We're not grabbing them. They're just like everything's a flower in and of itself that we learn to leave alone. And this radical leaving things alone is not a poverty but a richness. It allows for the deep wellsprings of our life to inform us, to be the source of our thinking, source of our feeling, source of our love, source of our reverence, source of our joy and delight. So the more we can have nothing, the more we have the richness of what it is to be a human being. But we don't want to hold on to that richness, because then we lose the richness. It's a richness that can only be there when we don't hold on. So the last thing I want to say in this talk then is that this tremendously important absence of clinging can become a reference for understanding our life as we go forward. And the more we've let go, the more we've let go of something that we've been holding on to, it's very valuable to appreciate the absence of what's been released. It's very useful to really feel and sense and give time to let it register. Oh, this is what it's like for this jealousy I've had for so long, this shame that's been dodging me for years, the anger that I keep having, the fear that keeps always there. For some reason, I don't know why, it's gone now. There might be times when the sense of self dissolves enough and you say, wow, I'm not self-conscious. For 2 minutes, I was not self-conscious. It's an absence, absence of self-consciousness, absence of these motivations of jealousy or greed or whatever it might be. Take time to appreciate that. Those absences are also a kind of flower. There's something there that though the absence of something is a something to have reverence for and care with and support for. And one of the reasons for that is that the more you can understand what it's like to be alive without attaching or clinging to something, the more you get a feeling for what freedom from some things is, the more that becomes your teacher, your guide, to find your way to further and further, greater and greater movements, path of freedom, greater and greater letting go. You get a feel or a sense, well, that's what freedom is. The door has been opened a little bit, and now you see the light that comes through the door. And so now you can begin opening the door further and further. But if you don't see the crack in the door, it wouldn't occur to you to swing it open more and more. So the more you're attuned to freedom, the more you're aware of non-clinging, the more that'll show you, oh, the path forward is not to clinging more. The path forward is to understand my clinging, understand the tension and pressure and holding, gripping in the mind, in the heart, in the belly, wherever it might be, and let it go, let it go, let it go, or allow it to be released. As I said the first day about holding the hand open and flat just to hold something, this is a really wonderful way to have an open hand, the open hand of awareness. And then with time, if something is supposed to go, it will. So you don't have to be too involved with trying to get rid of your clingings and attachments. But hold it lovingly and carefully. But don't feed it. Just hold it. And there's a freedom in that ability to just hold it. It's a freedom in just allowing each thing to be there in its uniqueness. Each thing is a flower. The flower of greed, the flower of hatred, the flower of conceit, the flower of pride, the flower of whatever it might be. Just see it. There's freedom in just holding it in the palm of your hand. And you can feel that freedom. You can feel that all around the attachment, there's space, there's openness, because we're not wedded to it. We're not entangled with it. We're clearly mindful of it. And then when it's ready to fly off or slip off the hand, it will. But it slips off more quickly when you really have a feeling for freedom. When you have a little, when you start having a sense of what this experience of absence is. And it's an absence which is nothing, it's an absence, but it is an absence which is whispering to you, come here, come home. This is the way forward, right here, where there's nothing, where you have everything. A place from where you may be ready to let go of much more than you ever imagined, bringing you to a place where maybe you'll be ready to bow to everything, either literally or somehow figuratively, to bow to your teacup, to bow to your neighbor, to bow to your difficulties and your joys, to bow to each tension and clinging that still remains. A freedom that maybe gives rise to a life of reverence and care for each and every one of us and for this world that we live in. And to be on retreat, and to sit and be quiet, to sit and be still, to have an intimacy and a clarity of the uniqueness of this moment, to see the flowers of the moment, to be close and relaxed, at ease. What is it to be found here? What is it? What great absence is here for you that will make you rich? So thank you for your practice and your engagement. And I hope that my wish for you is that you will take really good care of yourself in this phase of the retreat. Trust the momentum of the practice that's in you. Don't believe the thoughts that say that there's no momentum. Trust that there is. And stay close and go at the speed of mindfulness. Or better, go at the speed of freedom. That speed in which you can really, really feel some quality of freedom moment by moment. May you be free. Thank you.